This is the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast for November 26th, 2019. Welcome to the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast. My name is Drew Messenger-Michaels, and I'm glad you're here. Where I am, as you're hearing this, is on a plane to Japan. Lauren and I will be there the rest of the year. And so that I can focus on doing Japanese stuff, I am going to go ahead and deliver to you, time-shifted but faithfully on schedule, a bunch of interviews I've already recorded. Zach Barth is going to come back to talk about Molex Synthèse, the new Zachtronics game. Phoebe Watson is going to talk about Chaos Tavern. But before any of that, we're going to talk to C.S. Wallace about Killer Queen Black. That's what's happening this week. It's going to be a good time. We're going to do the year in review after the new year this year. It's going to be me and Lucio and Franny. And the reason we're doing it is twofold. The reason we're doing it that way, I should say. First, last time when it was just me and Franny doing it, it ended up being as much about looking forward as looking backward. So it doesn't necessarily need to be an end of the year thing. And also the second reason is hot take. The games that were good in 2019 are still going to be good in 2020. So look forward to that then and to this trio of interviews before that. Couple of quick notes about this one in particular. We mentioned Bumble Bash a few times. That is the annual get-together of Killer Queen players and all things Bumble Bear Games. That's the studio that makes Killer Queen. We talk a little bit about With Friends, and I refer to it as like Kickstarter, but for venues, which is really not true. It's more like Patreon, but for venues. Recurring payments to places you believe in and stuff, you know, whose stuff you like. Who do things you like to see done. But, you know, it's recurring as opposed to one time, so Patreon rather than Kickstarter, definitely the touch point there. Last but not least, at the very end of the interview, there's a reference to the physical edition of Killer Queen Black being about to come out. It's out. It comes with controller decals. Check it out if physical editions are your thing. With all that being said, enjoy.
Yeah, I think I'm good.
Awesome. Well, thank you a ton for taking the time. I know, you know, release time and post-release time, especially with a game this many people take this seriously, is always a little bit stressful. But it seems like things have been going pretty well, I think it's fair to say. Between this and Bumble Bash, I'm sure you've been really busy, though, and we'll talk about all that. But first things first, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So we'll start in the most boring place possible, and then I think generally branch out from there, find the hooks and hook into each. For anybody who has heard about the game or who hasn't heard about the game, but in general, who doesn't quite know what we're about to be talking about, what is Killer Queen Black?
Sure. So, Killer Queen Black is a new just released, multiplayer team. The best way I've seen to describe is a real time strategy platformer. And fits out for Switch and PC on Steam. And, basically it's unlike any other game that you have at home out there, but it's based on originally an arcade game that was actually based on a field game. So the arcade game came out in 2013, and this kind of is a 5-on-5 game, and this builds on the legacy of that. While it's built from the ground up for the home system, so we completely redesigned everything for online network play and for the Switch screen size and all those kind of things. But it has that same main gameplay. So the gameplay is on each team, one person is the queen, and then you have three workers, and the queen can fly around and attack, and the workers run around and jump like Mario. And the really unique thing about Killer Queen is that there are three ways to win. And those three ways are kill the enemy queen three times, fill your hive with berries for an economic victory, or ride a snail all the way to one end of the map.
Which is an instant win, but easier said than done, especially once you're playing against an attentive opponent.
Definitely, definitely. So the workers can pick up the berries and bring them back to the hive, and they can ride the snail. But they can also grab a berry and go in one of certain areas on the map called gates, and then they can come out as soldiers, and then they can fly and attack one or three different weapons and help either defend your team's win condition or help stop the other team's win condition.
Yeah, and the queen has, in addition to being combative, you know, killing soldiers and making sure economic victories are difficult to attain, the queen can also sort of lock down the gates to prevent the other team from transforming into soldiers. And the
exactly.
game can go in a bunch of different ways. I mean, it's a game of execution. Mm-hmm. It's twitchy to a certain degree, but it's also a game of teamwork and strategy, you know, obviously.
Absolutely.
And yeah. perhaps a little less obviously, it's a game of just being observant. It's a game about paying attention to a lot of things at once, you know, reading your opponent, mm-hmm. reading your teammates.
Yep.
And the original Killer Queen, what is now usually referred to as Killer Queen Arcade, that's sort of very mm-hmm. social, right? Like the other team is sort of on the other side of you or sometimes off to your left or right. You're sort mm-hmm. of aware of them and your team is very, very close to you. You're sort of bunched in and it's extremely social. Killer Queen Black can be
right.
played that way. You can hook eight players up to one machine, right? In the case of Switch, I believe. Or is it only four
no,
people?
No, only well, you need two Switches.
Totally. Yeah.
yeah,
exactly. So you could have eight people in the mm-hmm. room, but that's, you know,
you could,
a lot of people will play it online or some combination mm-hmm. of online and offline, which is a form of multiplayer
yep.
I treasure that isn't done that often. But like if you have two people in the room, the two of you can log on and it'll match you with six opponents.
Right. Yeah, and the game has a built-in voice chat system. So you see, especially at the highest levels of play, people queue up together with a team of four and they execute a strategy together. So the really, really good players will often play together, even if they're not in the same room, and be using the voice chat in the game to talk to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it has in-game voice chat, even on Switch, I was going to say, which is not
yep,
a thing
yep,
that
yep.
most games on Switch have, and is quite an accomplishment,
that's right.
I think.
Yeah.
Was that a challenge? Did that require, like, additional certification on Nintendo's part? Because I know they're kind of cagey about that kind of thing, even in their own games.
Probably. I'm not on the dev side of
gotcha.
That. So, yeah.
Fair enough. So your side of this was predominantly the actual, like, sort of nuts and bolts game design side, taking...
Yeah, so basically, I started on the project in January this year, basically to help do some finishing. So the first really big thing that I worked on was designing the entire tutorial. And that was great because I was able to play test with people at my day job who were both experienced gamers and people who hadn't maybe touched a game since they were a kid playing Super Mario. And I was really able to make sure that it was an experience that people could get through and understand the game, no matter where they were coming from. So that was really lucky that I had access to such a broad pool of people in my office.
It's an impressive tutorial because, I mean, every version of Killer Queen has those instructions. It sort of graphically mm-hmm. explains the three ways to win before each match.
Right.
But really, in the arcade setting, the tutorial, your tutorial is other people.
Yeah, it's someone grabbing you and saying, okay, yeah, put that berry in the hive. Oh, good, jump on the snail. Just could you ride the snail. Yeah. And then, like, you play it more and more and you start to pick up more and more over time. But for someone who might be, you know, just sitting at home and doesn't have people there to explain it to them, then, you know, if you jumped into a full game without understanding the three win conditions, without understanding how to come out and how gates have to be tagged your color, you know, it can definitely be a lot, and it would ruin both your experience and the experience of other people. So that was a big thing that we wanted to get in there.
Definitely. Yeah, it's a game where you can understand the basics of your role, or at least of a way of playing, quite easily. But then there's not even just nuances, but entire other ways to win, ways to play, ways to contribute that you might not know about. The gates are usually something people don't totally understand the very first time they play if they haven't had it explained
right.
to them, and maybe even if they have.
Right.
Or just sort of, you know, high-level snail tactics, where obviously if you're a soldier or a queen, you can kill the enemy unit who is on the snail, but if you're not,
mm-hmm.
you can sort of let the snail eat you to just delay it a few seconds.
Things
like that are... Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and this is the same as in the arcade. The number one thing you want to do, if you have support, another soldier on your team nearby, you can, because the snail eats workers and you can't move and you can't jump off the snail when you're eating, if someone is coming, basically it's a tactic to delay the snail. If you don't have soldiers out to kill the person riding it, you can feed yourself to the snail. You can sacrifice just to slow it down a little bit until maybe the queen can come to clear it. And what you want to do generally is jump off and then let the enemy person then eat you instead of you eating them, because then they're stuck on it. and then it's an easy kill for your teammate who's a soldier or queen to clear it. So if you have that backup, that's kind of the thing you want to do, but that's kind of more advanced.
Yeah, you'll sort of see people, you know, sort of twitching around the snail to try to get the other one to be the one on it, and it's, you know, it's baffling behavior if you're a new player, a newbie, if you will. And then all of a sudden you realize what they're trying to do, and it opens this entire new realm of tactics to you. There's a lot of moments like that.
Yeah, going back to what you were saying before about the game itself, is like there's two levels, right? There's, like you said, it's this twitchy. The tactics of it is like you're going back and forth. Oh, do I attack? Do I not attack? Can I bait the other player into attacking first so then I can attack them back? There's that level of it. And then there's the high level strategy of, okay, who on our team is doing what? Are we going to have one snail rider and two soldiers? Or are we going to have two berry runners and one soldier helping defend against their win condition? So those are the kind of things that it's really interesting to see all these new players who haven't played the arcade game start to figure out. Because obviously all the people, you know, who've played the arcade game for years, they're coming in and like, okay, this is the most efficient way to push your win condition while stopping the other teams. But, you know, you see a lot of new players be like, oh, I can't run a berry. Let me jump on the snail for a bit. And, oh, that's not working. Let me do this. And they don't have that overarching vision of trying to push one condition to victory.
No, definitely. They're throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks. I've seen some of the other folks who've worked on the game a few times sort of say that if you have played the arcade game, you know, if you start with one and go to the other, it's a bit like speaking Spanish and then trying to learn Italian or vice versa. Like there are things that are transferable, but you're not going to be fluent in one because you're fluent in the other.
Yeah. And it's definitely that high level strategy stuff, I would say, is more transferable because the game plays and feels completely differently. Like the characters, like I've mentioned before, it was redesigned completely for online net play. So instead of the joust mechanic in the arcade of being higher or behind and colliding with someone to kill them, you have to hit a button to attack, and there's different weapons that all behave completely differently. So it just, that's all completely different. And then the characters are larger relative to the size of the maps to fit on the Switch screen size.
The maps are denser because it's now 4v4 rather than 5v5.
That's correct.
Yeah, which it's a fascinating exercise in game design to me, because you'd be forgiven if you don't really play the game for looking at a screenshot of Killer Queen Arcade and looking at a screenshot of Killer Queen Black and thinking, oh, they're the same. But once you've played both, it sort of is impossible to think of them as the same. I mean, obviously they're not night and day different, but they're very
different.
The style
is like, if the arcade is like NES style pixel art graphics, then Killer Queen Black would be like Super Nintendo.
Yeah. It has a different look. I mean, that's very true. Even if you're not thinking about the gameplay, you can sort of squint. If you're attentive, you could see what the difference is in the graphics. But even if you're looking at gameplay and you're not quite attuned to that, you know, from the outside, it could seem the same, and yet it feels quite different. That to me is fascinating, and it seems very smart to me that rather than trying to do a straight adaptation of something that is very fundamentally an arcade experience and has those jousty mechanics that would be utterly ruined by even the slightest amount of lag, you've taken you've taken the same basic idea, the same basic aesthetic, and made something new out of it. Like that seems to me a better plan, and one that maybe happens less, because like the temptation, of course, is to say this thing worked, let's make it work somewhere where there are more players and just, you know, put it in their hands.
It's a smart thing.
Has the reception from old school players been sort of do they grok that it's the same thing but a different thing, or is there frustration that it's not quite the same thing?
A lot of the really good arcade players have actually been playing it, and so it's been really nice, actually, because, you know, here I'm part of the New York arcade scene, and, you know, we'll go out on whatever night to whatever spot that has it, and it's like, okay, you're hanging out with your friends and having a beer, and that's great, playing Killer Queen. And every few months, maybe we'll fly to another city and see other really good friends that we only see a few times a year. But now it's like, oh, I can play Killer Queen with my friends from Chicago or Portland or wherever all the time now. So that's kind of a nice thing about it. So actually, just last night, I had two friends over from the arcade scene here in New York, and we were playing with people from Chicago and Portland and Phoenix all together. So
That's beautiful.
Yeah, it was pretty
That's
fun.
Beautiful, yeah. I mean, because I love the fact that there are local Killer Queen scenes and that they're, you know, like people who are interested will coalesce around a machine. I've always had really good times playing Killer Queen everywhere I've played it. Mm-hmm. I think it's the kind of game that really encourages people to sort of work together, collaborate, share information.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the strongest thing about it is, like, because you need a lot of people to play, it forces you to say, hey, random person at the bar over there, come play this game with us. Yeah. And be open and friendly. And I think that's one of the main reasons that the arcade scene is one of the most open, positive, friendly communities in video games or esports right now.
I had Alan Dang on and he was talking about that as well, that, you know, mm-hmm. the importance of sort of maintaining that, you know, what it's hard to define, right? Yeah. That attitude, that posture, that mm-hmm. like to be very protective of that thing that doesn't happen in all scenes, even when the game itself is sort of good natured. And I think he said, you know, for him, it kind of comes down to just the relationship that the players have with the people who make the game. Like, first of all, realizing that people mm-hmm. made the game, which is not something people always realize.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, we have a really active Discord with, I think, over 1,000 people in it. And, you know, the other devs are in there. I'm in there. We're all talking with people all the time, taking feedback, saying, yeah, we're working on this bug. Sorry. And I think people are really appreciating that level of communication that we have with them.
Yeah, absolutely. Did Killer Queen Black change in significant ways as a result of feedback from players during development? Like,
definitely. This was before I had even played the game, but last fall there was an open beta. And I know there was a lot of changes based on that in terms of the basic game feel. And then we ran our last open beta in July and had a ton of people playing in that. And there were definitely a lot of changes, especially to some of the maps and some of the UI. And still a lot of things that we have to do based on that. But in that open beta, we got a lot of really good feedback. Because especially for like some of the map designs, you can't really see what's wrong until you see two high-level teams really finding the emergent strategies and things like that. So, yeah.
Because, I mean, I definitely played it. You know, my exposure to it, obviously, before it was out, was mostly at conferences and things like that. And I did mm-hmm. see it change a bit, you know, even conference to conference.
The arcade game is constantly being changed and worked on.
Yeah, it's interesting. Sure. The idea, instead of, you know, pulling a Street Fighter, I suppose, and like doing what fighting games or whatever used to do in the old days when it was time to change. Killer Queen is an arcade game. Killer Queen Arcade, I should say, is an arcade game that gets patched, you know, but
all the time. And I think, you know, that's it's really turned out great the way Nick and Josh are just so involved in the community and not having like a top-down approach, but like letting the community tell them, you know, what they like, what they don't like. The biggest change that I remember is about 2 years ago, because I remember them mentioning one time that, just to give you some more background on the arcade game, awesome. For the people who don't know, it's Joust, right? So whoever's higher gets an attack and gets the kill when you collide with someone. So if you're above or behind. So the safest place to be if you get attacked from above is with your head on the ceiling. And so early players realized the safest thing to do is to tap the button as fast as you can to maintain a consistent position with your head against the ceiling. And we call that crown scraping. And that was a behavior that Nick and Josh didn't anticipate in the original prototypes. And to do that consistent crown scrape early, you had to tap the button 10 times a second. And that's a lot of tapping. So that's like, you know, fighting game players could do it, or people who just happen to have that physical skill could do it. But about half the, you know, regular players in the competitive scene couldn't maintain a consistent ground scrape. And it's like, the goal of this game isn't to be about your physical ability to tap this button quick. It's about communication with your team and strategy and like all of those high level things. And so they reduced that number to 6. And now it's, you know, you don't have to tap as fast. So that was a big thing. There's day map. Once people got good at becoming warriors, then berries became really, really hard to run and get the economic victory on the day map, which is the original map. And in, I think it was just this last year, they added in some new berry patches closer to the hive that pushed that a little bit more to be viable. And another platform a little bit before that, closer to the hive. So there's two ways into it instead of one. So it's, you can't just block that one spot. It's things like that, constant map changes. And also, you know, they just released a few months ago the beta version of another new map. So that's the fourth map now. where the game originally had one day map and then night map and then dusk map. And so there's always been iterating on the maps, trying to make them more stable and balanced and competitive.
This new one is what is, to the consternation of all concerned, ending up getting called Meat Map by the community. Am I correct there? Or,
yeah. Yes. Yeah, the original art, there's a tall column in the middle of the map, and it kind of looked like, basically uncooked meat in an early art prototype. But that's been taken out, but the community still calls it that.
Yeah, it's hard to get rid of those things once they stick. Yeah. And it's because that gets passed around, like important knowledge. Yeah, so...
Yeah.
Whether it's important.
It's called, it's the official name, I think, if there is one, is Twilight now. Okay. But
well, that makes sense, given Dusk and Dawn and Day and Night. And that, I mean, you know, day, night, dusk, meat. Those are my day, but you know, I know not everybody lives the way I live, and that's fair enough. I'm fascinated by that process of deciding which glitches or exploits or just unexpected behaviors or effects more generally should become part of the game. And in this case, you know, you took something that was in the game, wasn't intended to be, but you generally the team, right? Took something that but was very hard to execute and actually made it easier to execute. It's so interesting to think of if other games took that
path. Once the players get used to something being in the game, then if something changes that, then even if it wasn't an original design thing, quote unquote, it's become a part of the competitive gameplay of it, and you don't want to take that out. So another example, like earlier a few months ago, they fixed a bug that happened where you could like slightly get above into a platform on the corner of a platform, but then that caused warriors to be actually as high as a queen sometimes, and so they had to patch that. But then that made it harder for queens to what's called a J dive, go down and immediately under a ledge. And so they had to do another update to fix it, to make it feel more like it did before, even though they had fixed this other bug. So things like that.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So by the time you joined Killer Queen Black, were most of the big decisions about how, I mean, I know the really big decisions, like
all the core stuff was in there in terms of like the three weapons, and all the maps had been basic designed. The tutorial hadn't been done yet. And a bunch of UI screens, and I'm trying to remember just like all the things we've done over the last few months. It's been such a whirlwind.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, just like all these kind of little bug fixes and tweaks all over the place.
Tell me a little bit about the process of sort of crafting that tutorial for a game that is famous for a while to understand. You know, first of all, I suppose, was your goal to onboard brand new players primarily while sort of making it tolerable for... The expectation was that people who've played Killer Queen Arcade don't necessarily want a tutorial. They want to dive in and see what's different.
Yeah, if you've played the arcade before, like, you probably don't need it as much, even though there's some new things, you figure it out quickly enough, and you're probably in a Slack or a Discord or something, or talking to people, and they can tell you. But this is for like the random person that has bought it as a whim or isn't involved in any of the online stuff, or maybe they saw it in GameStop. It's going to physical Switch is coming out on Friday. And so, you know, someone might just buy this game and have no idea what it is because it looks cool. And so, or some parent might buy it for their kid, right? So, we wanted to design it so that the completely brand new player that may have 10 years of experience playing video games or no experience playing video games would be able to play and understand the game going into online. Because, like I said, you know, if you go into an online match and you have no idea what's going on, it's bad for you.
Right.
And it's bad for everybody. So,
yeah, totally. It's not necessarily a positive experience to jump in and completely get your ass handed to you.
Exactly. And we went back and forth on, should we lock out like maybe at least ranked mode until you've completed the tutorial, or things like that, or lock queen play until you've completed the tutorial. In the end, we decided against that just because, you know, just let people play.
And I could certainly imagine someone who's new to this game, perhaps even new to games or hasn't played in a while, diving straight into ranked mode, not quite understanding the full implications of that and having a bad time.
Sure.
But, you know, they would probably, hopefully, quickly understand that, oh, this is the place where serious players play. I could go elsewhere, you know?
Right. Yeah, and the way it works is, like, it gives you 10 placement matches.
Right,
so...
Right.
It'll kind of figure out where you are really quick.
That I've been pretty impressed with the matchmaking. I've yet to have, in ranked mode anyway, like a bad match. Like I've gotten my ass kicked and I've done well, but it's never been a complete shutout and it's never been a complete cakewalk. It's been pretty
great to hear.
Part of that is probably the fact that the game draws from a cross-platform pool of players. So if you're on Switch, you might encounter PC players and vice versa.
That's right.
The first time I saw Miis on Steam, I was like, wait a minute. You know, it was, that's beautiful.
Yeah, no, it was really important that we get the cross-platform in there at launch, because having, you know, only Steam players together, only Switch players together, only Discord Nitro players together was just, would not have been good for the game. So, and actually that's what the dev team is crunching on right now, is cross-party. So they're working on a built-in friends list that, you know, someone on Switch can partner with someone on Steam
Fantastic.
And they'll be able to queue up
for anybody who hasn't seen it. When you log in, it's only looking for your friends on the platform you're playing on, and you can get matched with people who are playing on other platforms. But if you're on Steam, let's say, you can't party up with someone on Switch.
That's right. It uses your Steam friends list or your Switch friends list.
Exactly. That's fantastic, because that feature makes it truly cross-platform in a way that I'm not sure I can think of a game that's quite that sort of flexible. That's really, really neat. Mm-hmm. And that couldn't have been easy to get working. I know that wasn't your main focus.
Yeah, they're working on that really hard right now. The dev team, I've just been so impressed with them the whole time. They're really fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really beautiful engineering feat, and it's also just, I was amazed when I finally played it at home and got to like dig in a little bit more at just the confidence of it. Like, it really doesn't play like it's trying to be all things to all people. Like, it, the promise of this is going to be its own thing, based on this thing that a passionate fan base already knows a great deal about, is the sort of promise that could make one paint oneself into a corner, I think. But it seems like all of the choices that have been made were very intelligent ones. And yeah, the onboarding experience for, you know, people who I've played with, who have never played Killer Queen Arcade because they've never had the wherewithal or never been near enough to one, they've all gotten it pretty quickly, you know, and definitely,
that's great to hear.
You know, I have one friend who is never going to play a tutorial in his life. If he's forced to, he'll just sort of spam A or whatever. He wants to learn. Lucio, for anybody listening who's on the podcast a whole bunch, he really just wants to learn by doing. And he had a pretty good experience too. I mean, like, you know, I realized I had explained some stuff
badly. That was my idea with it, is like,
I go back and forth, actually really quick, let me reconnect the recording bot, which is disconnected for some reason. You're recording yourself, so it shouldn't be a big deal, but, you know, it's always better to have it than not have it. Killer Queen is simpler than a lot of RTSs in a certain sense, right?
But it's
also not that damn simple. So I'm consistently amazed by how quickly people can grab it.
I think it's deceptively complicated. Like, people see a 2D single screen game and they think, oh, deathmatch, like Towerfall, like last one standing wins kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, it's definitely nowhere near as complicated as an RTS, where you have to manage resources and, you know, build structures and your whole tech tree and all that kind of stuff. But
that same thing is like, Spelunky is simple if you play roguelikes, but if you do not play roguelikes, Spelunky seems almost infinitely complicated.
Depends on how
players are certainly going to come to it, you know.
Yeah, and I think it's just something that Nick and Josh stumbled upon, is like, you know, this amazing gameplay system of these balanced three win conditions, and it's translated from that original field game to the arcade to this home system. So it's been really great to see.
Do you continue being involved post launch on the same? Yeah. So what is your role right now? Are you working?
Basically, we have a lot of stuff planned coming up right now. So I've been talking with the community a lot, the top level players, about the current maps. And even though, you know, I made a bunch of fixes, like basic things like positioning of the berry patches and the holes to make them easier to get into, and, you know, balancing the maps a little bit, there's a lot of emergent stuff coming out now that, like, I never saw, like, people do. So the maps
are you hesitant to outline that too specifically in a public forum, or is there a juicy example that you'd like to?
Well, in terms of like a really cool thing I saw the other day, and I told one of the streamers, like, oh, I saw someone doing this and I thought it was really cool, and they were like, oh yeah, that's the new meta on that map. And I was like, oh wow, okay. I guess I need to play more. So of course they had already known about it because they've been playing nonstop. But basically, people are on one map called the Black Queen's Keep. There's a berry patch under a platform, next to a wall with a slight gap there, and people are jumping up and throwing the berry against the wall up to the top of that platform, and then another worker stands there and throws them directly into the hive. So we've definitely seen some like two worker chains of throwing berries, but I hadn't seen them being thrown up like that. And then there's like another map that I was playing last night, and I saw something for the first time with some of the KQA players, and their entire team of just workers just started throwing berries like nonstop. And it was, we just started cracking up because it looked hilarious. But then, you know, it was actually really hard to counter. So
yeah, the time that I have been most mercilessly destroyed, Lucia was there too. We were not recording, unfortunately, so there's no record of this happening, but I think it was the Black Queen's Keep, and yeah, that they must have been doing what you're talking about, because they just like, we saw a storm of berries and then we had lost by economics. Like, just
yeah,
like,
the one that I'm talking about with that is the Helix Temple, which looks like a jungle theme, and it has a big snail shaped temple in the back.
Sure.
Yeah, the hives on the side.
Throwing seems extremely powerful and easy to screw up because not only can you miss, but because we haven't said this explicitly, but there's sort of screen wrapping, like a lot of old arcade games. So there are lots of scenarios in which if you're throwing a berry where it needs to be for you, you can sort of score not quite an own goal, but the berry can end up in a very convenient place for the other team's workers, which you don't want.
And there's some maps where the hives are right next to each other, so you can definitely throw them through a gap under the wall into the other person's hive if you miss, or just throw it directly into their holes.
Which you don't want. Oh man, I've never done that. So you can actually get, I haven't seen it happen, but you can totally just throw it directly into someone else. That sucks. I mean, it's fantastic, but it sucks. It sucks in a fantastic way. That's another thing that I've always been impressed with this game. It's maybe just that I have good memories of playing Killer Queen Arcade and having a good time and having people be friendly, but it's not a game that feels all that bad to lose at for me. Like, I know, like, if you're in a really intense match and you lose, that feels bad. And I know it's also, your mileage may vary. Some very competitive people truly hate losing on a visceral level.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you are a worker and you get paired up with a queen that has no idea what they're doing,
it's
really easy to lose, and that feels bad for sure. But if the two teams are balanced evenly enough and your whole team knows what they're doing on the same level, then even if you do lose, like, it's mostly funny most of the time, I find.
Yeah, I mean,
it usually comes down to some super close situation that's super intense, and like that drama of like, oh, we've almost got the snail in, are they going to get the last berry in, like what's going to happen? And then like, either, you know, I play queen usually, so like I'll do something and just completely mess up, and I'm like, oh man, sorry guys, like I should not have done that. Or you know, some funny interaction happens with the characters, and it's like, okay, the last berry went in, but it was really funny how it did. So
yeah,
it's okay.
One thing I've seen more in Black than in the arcade, and maybe that's a function of the density of the maps or something, is just, I've had the experience in arcade, I should say, where people kind of fart around for a while because there are enough new people playing, or someone leaves partway through a match or whatever, where things get a little bit slow. I've never had a slow match of Black.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no, it's definitely so much more fast paced than
it becomes clutch if you're inattentive at all. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Basically, like, if you're not constantly moving forward to push your win condition from the get-go, then probably the other team's going to win really quick. Unless they're also just, like, wandering around, not doing much, or going back and forth between berries and snail, not really moving them.
I've definitely, the closest thing I've come to a slow match, or the closest thing I've seen to one, is where there's a lot of fighting over the snail, and so it just ends up not getting very far in either direction. But usually, in that case, under the nose of the workers who are focused on the snail, there's either a military victory or an economic victory.
Right. Yeah. That's an interesting thing that I've seen a lot of new players like, oh, it's so many military victories. But most of the time what happens is you're pushing your win condition, whether it's snail or berries, forces the queen to get into a place where she's on her back foot and has to defend against that. And then because she has to react to you can capitalize on that and know where she's going to have to be. So if your snail's about to go in and they don't have any soldiers, the queen has to be there to kill that worker. And so, you know, she's going to dive on it. Right. So that's, Yeah.
And by on the other side of the coin, I should say, I was going to say by the same token, but that's like exactly the opposite of what I meant. So anyway, idioms, on the other side of that coin, if a team goes completely aggro and is all soldiers, they can't get a snail victory. Only a worker can ride a snail.
I've been seeing a little bit of that where a team will come out as all soldiers, And it's like, okay, if the queen is good, you can just keep running. And it's hard because the maps are so small, so that if you have three soldiers and a queen coming after you, then you're probably going to get hit eventually. But if you can stay alive long enough, then, you know, something's going to happen. Like, either the berries are going to keep moving in, especially if you have just a few left, like a berry is going to bounce into that hole eventually, or the snail is going to move just enough while everyone is chasing you. So yeah, it's going full military is just as dangerous as in the arcade game for you.
One of the big differences in terms of options for the martial approach, I suppose, is that there isn't a gun in this one. It's the arcade game is sort of stubbornly melee.
Yeah, and that actually comes from, you know, sometimes new players will step onto the arcade cabinet, and based on the way the sprite is of the warriors, it kind of looks like they're holding a gun. Mm-hmm. So sometimes new players will come up and they'll say, oh, how do I shoot? And so it's like, okay, here, now you can shoot.
I know that was one thing that at least in theory was controversial among longtime arcade players. Like there were several people I just like bumped into at conferences who said, like, mm-hmm. how did you play Killer Queen Black? There's a gun in it, right?
Yeah, once you try it a few rounds, you realize like, this is fun as hell.
Yeah. And it makes a big, crazy sound. It can go basically across the
entire
screen, but it's not like...
It's tricky to use.
Yeah, and the bolt itself is not instantaneous. It's not like a laser. It like takes a second to get across the screen, so there are situations where you could dodge it. I think it's pretty well balanced.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's really good, especially because the snail's always just that straight line. So whether the other team's trying to push it and you just keep popping the worker from across the map, or if, you know, the queen is trying to stop you because you're really close, you can really take advantage of that with the gun. Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to shift a little bit because I think you were sort of uniquely qualified to do the work you're doing on this, not just because of Killer Queen knowledge and engagement with people, but also because of the previous game you made. I want to direct people toward Three Nights in Chicago.
Sure. Yeah. I mean,
am I a jerk if I make you describe that one too? Cause I think it's, it defies description just a little.
Well, this was my thesis project at the NYU Game Center, the graduate game program there. Master's program there, and it's a local multiplayer game. It started off as one-on-one, and before Overcooked came out, we came out this mechanic actually from Killer Queen. Like, when we were in the prototyping stage, we were like, oh, what is it like if you stand at the Killer Queen cabinet, and then if you die, you just move to the next spot? And we were playing with that, and we were like, oh, what if you had two characters controlled by one person, and you could switch off between them? And this was before Overcooked was even announced, so...
Something in the water. That's interesting.
Yeah. So basically, you're two teams of bank robbers, like 1930s gangster style, and you're trying to get more... You're both robbing the same bank at the same time. And you're trying to get more money at the end of the round. And so basically, you know, you'll move one character over here, start to open a safe, switch to the other one, come over, maybe try and stop the other team, do some melee fighting. Oh, the safe opens, switch back, get the money to the car, switch back over here. And so there's a lot of interesting design around the levels and ways we could make players use the two characters, like switches where one has to stand on a switch to open a door to get to a safe.
Kind of Lost Vikings style, that one player co-op thing going on.
Yeah. Things like vents where you drop the money here and it comes out over here. So different ways to use the two characters in interesting ways. So that was the original. But then at a certain point, someone suggested that, oh, why don't we just make it 2-on-2 also? So it was actually not that hard to add in the code to just use two players instead. And I think people like that even more. So yeah, I mean, people enjoyed it as a fun party game, and, you know, we had just graduated school and needed to get jobs, so we didn't really continue working on it, but, you know, we just threw it up on itch for $5 and sold like 20 copies, so that was that.
that's the end of the story. Well, I'll see if I can help make that not quite the end of the story, and I'll link it. It's fun.
That's fine.
But it also, I mean, it shares some DNA with Killer Queen. I don't know how much.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. I mean, even the way to try the switching positions on the Killer Queen cabinet is one of my teammates, Carl. And but yeah, it's interesting how like there's that back and forth, and then my experience with that is what kind of got me into also helping with Killer Queen Black.
Yeah, that's another thing that I find really interesting. When someone makes a game, not derivative of, but inspired by, clearly emerging from in some way, a game, and then ends up working on that game, or something very much like it. That seems like a very NYU story in a certain sense. Just like,
yeah,
cross-pollinating.
Definitely.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, like I said, I'll link to the game. It's very good fun. I think the AV Club called it Smash Brothers meets Ocean's 11 or something.
Yes.
It puts me a little bit in mind of the heist mode in the multiplayer of Conker's Bad Fur Day. Is that too deep a cut? I don't know.
I haven't actually played that.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's 3D obviously, and it's N64 3D to boot. So it's, you know, it's a very specific feel, but you're these like gangster weasels, and it's just about like, you have to go into a vault, steal some money and get back out. And you know, how much are you focusing on stopping the other person?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I've never played that.
It's, wow. It's a good, I mean, I don't know how you play it. Is it in the Rare Replay thing that came out a few years ago? I mean, you could emulate it, but we would never condone the slightest trespass against the sacrosanct laws of intellectual property here on the podcast. So. But anyway, that was a touch point I thought of. But the other thing I thought of was immediately Killer Queen, right? Just in the sense of, like, it's fascinating to know that it comes out of a specific experience you can have at an arcade cabinet, that moving from slot to slot, because that's a thing that happens emergently. But I've never seen a game that's quite about that before, at least not officially.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it didn't end up really being about like switching positions like that, but just switching your characters actively, because it was something we had played with pretty early on before it was even about the 1930s gangsters theme. Mm-hmm. Like basically, in an early prototype, it was like leave one of these characters in an active position, kind of also like it's on the tip of my tongue, the aliens and the tactical and the. You know, the one where you have the characters permadeath and XCOM. Okay, XCOM.
Oh, you're thinking about XCOM. Yeah. Totally.
Yes. So that was one of the, like, basically, like, you leave this character in an Overwatch position where if someone comes near them, they'll fire at that character or something like that. And then you switch to the other one. So we took that out because we found the UI to be too complicated for a two-player, like, multiplayer single-screen game.
And managing two characters is already a lot to manage without thinking about sort of AI.
Yeah,
scripts.
So like for a slow tactics game where you can like pick from menu, it worked more than like trying to actively pick which state you want to leave them in as you're switching the character. And maybe it could be done, but we couldn't execute on it. So yeah, but anyway.
So are you especially interested in sort of arcade games or this perspective? This sort of, I mean, I guess I'm a little bit obsessed with how different Three Nights in Chicago is from Killer Queen, and yet how similar, right? Like, is that your lane, or is it just sort of
into doing Three Nights in Chicago is like, I just really enjoy local multiplayer games and the idea of bringing people together in a space and playing together and building connections between people, which is, you know, what Killer Queen Arcade is all about. Like you look at the community and there's people who have, you know, found life partners and gotten married from playing the game. And there's people who have just found their people as a community through the game. And it's really changed so many lives. And, you know, you talk to anyone in the community and you immediately see how it's affected people's lives in such a strong way.
Absolutely.
And so that kind of thing is what I really love. And, so yeah, I guess, you know, my hope is that Killer Queen Black does that a little bit in the way that the arcade game has as well.
That's maybe something else that comes through with Killer Queen Black, is that it's built, you know, a lot of the time when you ask someone, like, where did the idea for this come from? It's like, well, I like X kind of game, but I wondered what it would be like in the format of Y kind of game. Or I was working on X and then I put in an idea from when I was working on Y or whatever. Killer Queen and Three Nights in Chicago are similar in that they don't really emerge from that place. They emerge from like a social phenomenon or a kind of social interaction that they want to foster. Mm-hmm. So even though they don't look unbelievably experimental or unconventional, they come from this place that's a little bit unconventional or different, or not anti-commercial, but maybe commercialism agnostic.
Three Nights in Chicago was where we ended up, was a lot simpler, but our original idea was like, what if we took this from this game and this from this game and like this from this and this, and there was like four different things and like none of it came together. So we had to simplify the hell out of it to get it to where it was and actually make sense.
Ask yourself what the actual interesting part
was. Exactly. Like we had all these ideas for it, but we had to let it just be what it was going to be in the amount of time that we had left and the resources that we had as a team to make it. So we had all these grandiose plans for like this epic story and emergent narrative and, you know, permadeath like XCOM, where you care about these characters in this world. And but also it's got great, you know, side-scrolling multiplayer gameplay. And it just, So it ended up, you know, in a pretty good spot considering, but we definitely were too big with our vision, I think.
That willingness to edit is probably A, how it gets out the door, and B, how you end up with something that, you know, what's there is actually pretty special.
But, yeah, and then Killer Queen coming from, like, originally a field game maybe come out and play was, you know, definitely, you know, just bring people together in a space the whole time. Yeah. And I think that's Nick and Dasha's big thing is, like, they're all about making the new arcade, the modern arcade games that, you know, bring people back together in the space to build those connections with people.
Yeah, the best times I've had in New York playing Killer Queen have been at Wonderville, which is very much a space about that. For anybody who is in the New York area and has not checked it out, it's a fully indie, really cool arcade, barcade, what do you call it? It's bigger than that. It's like a community space.
Yeah, I mean, it's a nonprofit, like, it's a bar, but it also has, like, this nonprofit called Death by Audio Arcade that just, they have this collection of new modern arcade cabinets that aren't, you know, it's not like going to Barcade where you have like Turtles in Time and Pac-Man and all that kind of stuff. This is like all new weird games made by mostly local New York people. So
indie,
it's really
indie
cool
pinball stuff, like A Place to Bury Strangers, like really just like crazy shit. And there's music there and all of that. It's a really cool venue and worth checking out. And like you say, it's connected to sort of a bigger, like Death by Audio used to be more than Death by Audio Arcade is what's left of Death by Audio, but it was sort of a bigger arts collective space that is sort of, I don't know, it's in hibernation. I don't want to say it's fallen due to gentrification, but Wonderville is one.
Yeah, I think
one
Vice,
part of it that's alive.
I think Vice is the company that took over the original Death by Audio space.
Right, which
Vice offices.
Deep irony on deep irony. It's a it's a damn shame. So, but like obviously having venues is an underappreciated part of what's necessary for you know, if you want to foster connection in a space.
Right.
Wonderville, Baby Castles in New York, you know, sort of use With Friends, I believe. I believe they both use, I'll double check this, but the platform that is sort of, it's like Kickstarter, but for venues, right? Like, that's a really important thing, and I think people need to sort of support their local institution should they have one, and, you know, obviously have more tools to start one if they don't. But I do want to ask, you know, as we start winding down, what do you think it is about online play that makes that harder? Like, am I overthinking this? And is it as simple as when you look people in the eye and you're close to them,
I think
you feel closer to them?
I think it's the anonymity of it. So, you know, if you're, you know, playing with this abstract idea of someone is out there in the ether controlling this character that I see on my screen, then just, depending on your personality, might not be as inclined to be as normal kind person I would be as if I met a random stranger on the street, and people don't treat people that way on the internet. But if you're in a bar and you're trying to get someone to play with you because you only have eight and you need two more, it's like, you're going to be friendly and open to try and get more people. And I don't know if it's something special about Killer Queen as well as a game, because it's like this weird bees flying around snail, what the hell's going on kind of game that does it attract a different kind of person than like a kind of Street Fighter or, you know, fighting skin game. I don't know if that's part of it as well. But
maybe the aesthetic,
just,
you know, I think you're right about that. And so, and there's a snowball effect, right? I mean, when I think of a game that's almost entirely online and still maintains sort of a good tone, I immediately think of Splatoon. Like, that's sort of an assiduously positive, you know, space,
even though there is
no Splatoon arcade cabinet for you to go play. There are
tournaments.
Killer Queen is probably similar in that it's got, you know, these weird bee bear hybrid things, which goes deliciously unexplained, I think. But it's also like that sets a certain tone, and then that tone is reinforced, I think you're right, by the social expectation that people are going to be welcoming and just generally not be assholes.
Yeah. And because actually Charles Pratt, who's one of the professors at the Game Center, gave a little talk at Bumble Bash 2 weeks ago about the history of the game and just thinking about the larger context of the game being usually situated in a barcade in an urban space, just the people and the culture of urban spaces in the 2000s is, you know, very different than, say, like the arcade culture of the 90s as well. So that's also just, you have a different demographic of people who are encountering the game then encountered Street Fighter cabinets in where they were in the 90s.
That's an interesting thought. It's not just the expectations when encountering it, but it's like who encounters it in the first place.
Exactly.
It's not like a subculture. It's, I don't know, it's a penumbra of multiple subcultures, or it's just whoever.
Right.
Yeah, somewhere between. That's an interesting thought. I'll see if that talk is online and link to it, if so.
I think it will be at some point if it's not yet.
Cool, cool.
Really good talk, yeah.
That's awesome. I'll look that up. I mean, the resurgence of the arcade is an interesting thing. And, you know, as with anything that's resurging, you know, most of them are relatively straightforward. Like you say, it's a place that serves beer and has beer holders on a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles machine. And there's not a thing in the world wrong with that. But it's very different from these sort of like a place like Wonderville. It's a curated art space, but without any of the fear of sort of sociability and loudness and fun that an art space is sort of associated with.
Yeah, and most of the places that Killer Queen is in the country is more in that barcade space. It's just the barcades in New York said, we only want retro games, we're not going to take anything. But, you know, you have places like Updown in Minneapolis or Brewcade in San Francisco or Logan Arcade in Chicago. And it's, you know, they've got pinball machines, they've got your Bubble Bobble and your Pac-Man and your old stuff. But they're also like, oh, you know what, we'll take a chance on this new thing, too. And I think it's worked out for them really well in terms of fostering a really good community and customer base, to put it in those terms, for their
bars. Totally. One interesting side effect of that, though, is that, you know, I used to play Killer Queen in Chicago, and people, I knew people who played it regularly and, like, in fact, would go to Logan Arcade to play it, who had no idea that it was an indie game. Maybe didn't even know that it was a modern game in a certain sense, because it was in among all these other games that looked superficially similar, and just the fact that they were next to each other creates this sort of weird sense that the game is unstuck from time, though it's a game that gets patches, you know?
When you go to play these games at a bar, you're not necessarily, like at a barcade, you're not necessarily thinking like, oh, this game was made in the 70s, this game was made in the 80s, this game was made in the 90s. Like, okay, you play the one you like, and you know, unless you're like into the history of it, you're not going to really be thinking of it. So,
right. There are,
it's like, okay, Killer Queen was made in the 2000s. So
there are those spaces that sort of seek to educate while you're playing. Like they do organize it by decade or something, but you're totally right that that's not how most people, even within the relatively rarefied air of the resurged arcade, will interact with games. They just want something fun that they can play with the people they're there with, or with strangers they've just met.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I really, really enjoy the game. I'll obviously link to where people can get it. I will totally, and I really do think Three Nights in Chicago, while nowhere near as like polished or lavish a production, right, is a totally worthy and amazing way to spend a couple of half-drunk evenings.
Basically, everyone that played the game had fun and would always be laughing playing it, and, you know, we just didn't have the time or budget to do everything required to launch an indie game that you need to nowadays, so, you know, and we're fine with that, you know, it was what it was, and it got us where we are all now, so... You know, that's fine, but, you know.
Yeah, no, totally. Parts of promotion are very predictable, and it's like you have the money and the time and the wherewithal to do it or you don't. And of course, parts of it, the virality aspect, are quite mysterious. Who knows why things catch the zeitgeist or don't.
Yeah,
you know, people make a lot of money claiming to be able to predict that or bottle it, but end of the day, nobody can.
Like, for sure. I mean, the original Killer Queen arcade is like, Nick and Josh had no idea that here we were going to be 10 years later almost, like, having national tournaments with hundreds of people flying into a city to play the game that
I'll explain more in the intro that's what Bumble Bash is, because we've sort of alluded to it but not quite said, like, it's a giant congregation of people coming together to play, I guess, now both Killer Queens, you know, it's a Killer Queen con of sorts,
we're trying to make it more just about the modern arcade scene in general. So this year, Black Emperor, which is another Bumble Bear game, and we had Cosmotrons, and we had Switch and Shoot and Death Ball, and just a whole slew of other modern arcade games. And so the idea is that we're going to turn it into more of a celebration of the modern arcade.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. And that's a really, I think, exciting and thoughtful way to sort of give back to... Because again, what people are interested in is not just Killer Queen, it's the very idea of playing stuff together and new possibilities. So
that's right.
Yeah. So thank you a ton for talking to me about that space and about the particulars of coming into a game that is not your own, but that shares some of your sensibilities, and having to listen to players and previous developers. And that's a space that I think people don't think about as much. When they realize people make games, they think, oh, an auteur made this. But all of those sort of interesting in-between roles that require a ton of technical skill, soft skill, whatever, creativity more generally, you know, but where you're not completely starting with a blank page, that's probably way more common in game development, and
a
fascinating space to think about. Cool. Anything else you want to plug?
No, just also a reminder that the physical edition is coming out for Switch on Friday, so go pick up a copy. They come with controller skins with some cool art on it, so I'm really excited about getting those myself.
Yeah, that's really cool.
And yeah, please check out the game.
Yeah, for sure. Well, hey, thank you one more time for being so generous with your time.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
For talking to us, and I hope you had as good a time as I did.
Definitely. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, totally. All right, have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye.
And that's the show. You can get Killer Queen Black on Steam and Switch. You can get Three Nights in Chicago on Itch. You can play Killer Queen Arcade in arcades and arcade-ish spaces across the nation, a list of which is linked in the show notes. And by the nation, I mean the United States. That was really kind of bizarre and America-centric. It just slipped out. Sorry. Know thyself, first and foremost. The Everybody's Talking at Once podcast is hosted and produced by me, Drew Messenger-Michaels, with all manner of high-tier on-meta strats from Francis Michelle Lopez of Lucio Valentino. Our logo is by Aaron Perry Zucker, using icons from The Noun Project, and you can find the show on Apple, Stitcher, Google, Spotify, Pocket Casts, Overcast, Breaker, Radio Public, and in every 4,000th Barry. Or at etaopod.com. Real quick before you go, some late-breaking news that broke while I was finishing up the episode. That update containing, among other things, cross-platform party support for Killer Queen Black, that's out now. So if you already own the game, check it out and enjoy it. I know I will. And if you don't own the game yet, now is a pretty good time to pick it up, both because of the update and because Killer Queen Black is discounted in the Humble Store now through December 3rd, on Steam now through December 5th, in the European Nintendo eShop now through December 1st, and in the North American Nintendo eShop tomorrow, November 27th, through December 4th. Yeah.